The Guardian.
Football Weekly Extra today. Cristiano, Juventus. Wow. First legs, see Mbappe left unhappy. Big Chris taking the mickey. And Wales in store for all concerned, really, after a remarkable midweek of action. We'll be licking our lips over all of that and then looking at the Premier League this weekend. Will Borough go down? Is that nominative determinism? Will Spurs close in on Chelsea and Man United at Arsenal? No defenders available. Mind you, same goes for Man United. Lols. All of that, plus Totti, racism in Serie A, Pisa, and Michael Cox's book in this Football Weekly Extra. Boom. And here we are, listeners. Here we are in your brain. Scary, isn't it? You've got a little Barry Glendinning in there.
May the force be with you.
Oh, yeah. Star Wars Day. Paolo Bandini's here.
Hello.
Hi, Paolo. And also, we've got author-to-be Michael Cox.
Hello, James.
All right, Michael. You're looking well. You're tanned.
Oh, thank you.
Where have you been?
I haven't been anywhere, actually. People keep saying that. I've just spent a couple of days at the cricket recently.
Right, that's it then, isn't it?
Yeah.
At the cricket. And Barry, you spent a few days at the snooker.
I did, yes. Great fun it was too.
All right. Good. Good. Well, we'll talk about all that stuff later on because we're going to begin with the Champions League. Whew. Hey, how about those for a couple of first legs of the semi-finals? They say that the lineup for Cardiff is already as defined as Cristiano's taut and tanned midriff.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of the paradox here, isn't it? I thought they were two really entertaining games on their own merits, but actually it means that the second legs are probably going to be a lot less entertaining because, yeah, I think it's very hard to see a way back for either Monaco or Atletico at this point.
Although, I noticed the commentator on the Monaco-Juventus game was saying from early on in the match, well, that's it, Juve through to the final. You cannot say that with... Had Monaco brought a goal back?
Yeah, look, I think there was a general tendency before the Monaco-Juventus tie to write Monaco off that I found a little bit baffling given how exciting they've been going forwards. And indeed, in that tie, in that game, there were opportunities. I mean, Buffon had actually kind of a storming evening and made a couple of fantastic saves from Mbappe. So you don't look at that Monaco team and say they're incapable of creating opportunities against Juventus. They've proven they can. What I would say is I don't think that Monaco team is capable of outscoring Juventus by more than two goals at the Jay Stadium where Juventus never lose.
Yeah, all right. Well, Monaco had chances, as you say. And yet, at the same time, weirdly, it never really looked in doubt in that match. But probably we should start with Tuesday's game and Big Ron. Are there words, Michael, are there words for Ronaldo?
Well, yeah, plenty of them. I mean, he's developed into a completely different type of player than he was a few years ago. Almost a penalty box poacher now. And basically had three chances, scored three goals. It was just sensational.
And this is him on the way out. Imagine how good he'll be when he actually retires.
Yeah, well, I mean, he's still kind of reigning World Player of the Year, which I think people tend to forget. You know, he probably isn't as good as he was 3 or 4 years ago, but him and Messi...
Wow, how good was he then? Because now his numbers are just ridiculous. I mean, there's been so many Ronaldo numbers thrown out there. It's hard to know which one to pick. But how about the fact that he's just scored back-to-back hat-tricks in Champions League knockout stages against Atletico Madrid and Bayern Munich?
Yes, not bad, is it? I mean, it's not so long ago. He was, in fact, in the first leg of that game against Bayern Munich, I think that he was being booed by his own fans.
That's the most amazing stat of all. Yeah, they booed him at the Bernabeu.
Yeah, I mean, we all seem to be obliged to have a favourite between himself and Leo Messi. And for my money, Leo Messi's still a better player.
Ooh.
Don's tin hat and awaits heavy artillery. But... I find Ronaldo's quite a selfish player. He's not a team player. He's visibly annoyed if other people on his own team score and he doesn't. But you just can't argue with his statistics. They're absolutely phenomenal. As Michael says, he has adapted his game now that he's not as quick as he used to be and he's pushing on a bit. And it will be interesting to see how long he can continue.
Yeah,
I think overall, apart from just Ronaldo's fantastic individual display, it was the best Real Madrid have played under Zidane by a long way in a big game. I've never really been that impressed by Real under Zidane, which might seem silly considering they're European champions.
Well, Jonathan Wilson casting some doubt on their quality on Monday, but this is a pretty effective riposte.
Yeah, and I think Zidane, what was impressive about that from his point of view is this was a tactical success. I mean, that was a sort of a hybrid, I don't know if you would call it a 4-3-1-2, but I mean, Isco was sort of such a free agent, you almost couldn't put him in any position. The first half in particular, he was all over the place. And I think that completely caught Atletico by surprise. You think Simeone, it's a cliche, but what everyone talks about with this team is how solid they are defensively, how robust they are. And you think he would have been preparing for this game for weeks. As soon as the draw was made, he would have been preparing for this game. And I think he caught Simeone completely cold with this idea. And I think in the first half, you really saw that. Funnily enough, two goals came in the second half. But the first half, Real Madrid had Atletico on the run. They were all over the place and they were attacking in with a conviction and a commitment that I think really surprised a lot of people. So I think, it's easy to say Zidane has walked into a situation where you expect to win. Of course he has. This is, you know, not where most people get to start their management. But I think that certainly on this occasion, I thought he showed some real tactical chops.
All right. How much influence do you think does Cristiano Ronaldo have over the management? He seems to be increasingly directing the team from on field. You can see him throughout the game kind of waving his arms here and there and do this, do that.
Yeah, I mean, look, he's clearly an enormous influence over them all the time. The thing which I know we've sort of done the stats, but now the thing I wanted to say with him, which is not really answering your question, but I just thought was worth raising, is he's now scored more goals, 52, in the Champions League knockout games than he has in group stage games. And I think that's sort of most extraordinary about how he keeps going this competition. It's not just like he's pummeling teams in the group stages. He scored, 103 goals in this competition,
yep.
And more than half of them have come in fewer than half of his games at the business end against the best teams in the tournament. So I think he's just, whatever you want to say about Ronaldo, he's an absolutely phenomenal big game player.
And with regard to his, directing operations on the field, he does, of course, have managerial experience from that time he managed Portugal to victory in the Euros last summer.
I think if he was in charge of picking the team, there's a good chance that he'd prefer Isco to play rather than Gareth Bale.
Right.
I think there's a growing sense from the Spanish press that they're not quite sure what Bale brings to this team. He's clearly a very good player, has contributed to their success, a European Cup success indeed. But Isco just brings something different. He links the play. And I think if you're going to have Ronaldo essentially just waiting in the penalty box alongside Benzema, you probably need a player like Isco who's connecting the team.
Right.
And he was fantastic in he was slightly fortunate not to be sent off, I think.
Isco.
Yeah,
which is why he was withdrawn.
Which is why he was substituted. But in terms of his possession play, it was David Silva-esque, James, as I'm sure you'd particularly appreciate.
Do you know that? It's funny because that's exactly the comparison which sprang to mind.
Yep.
As I settled down to watch Isco, because there's always so much said about him. I'll watch Isco, what he's about. And two words.
Yeah.
just to backtrack a little, because you were saying that you think he's not as good, Ronaldo, as he was 3-4 years ago. Would you stand by that? What's worse about him? Or would you just say he's different?
More than anything, he's different. But I think before he could create his own chances, he could get the ball 30 yards out, beat a defender, shoot from 25 yards and put it in the top corner. It's been a while since he's done that. And I think he does need more players creating chances for him. So I think he needs the team built around him now. But he's in terms of his goal return, I mean, there's no reason why it can't be better than it's ever been. It just means you need one extra player who's contributing to getting those chances in for him.
He did have one moment in the first half. It was the Benzema overhead kick that went over, where it was just a little flash of sort of old Cristiano, sort of standing on the sideline and doing like unnecessary shimmies and stepovers and then putting a ball in. But yeah, I mean, I agree with Michael generally. He's absolutely more of a striker now and more of a penalty box player.
Although I do wonder whether the fact that his current success has come after years in which he's kind of almost inured us to these kind of crazy numbers mean that we almost take less notice of him having 6 hat-tricks this season, 2 in the last 4 against Atleti, and then the other one against Bayern. I mean, and 1 in the Club World Cup final. It devastatingly effective.
Also, his second finish was really good. I mean, that was a really sweetly struck volley.
Can Juventus stop him, Paolo Bandini?
Well, if anyone can. I mean, there's certainly, I don't know if the minutes in front of me, they certainly have put together an incredible defensive run through this tournament.
621 minutes.
621 minutes without conceding a goal in the Champions
League. Over 10 hours.
Which includes two games against Barcelona, one game against this Monaco team that's been scoring goals for fun. Look, as I said earlier, they could have conceded goals this week. They probably should have done Buffon. You're right. The defending perhaps merited conceding a goal, but when you've got Buffon behind that defence, then you always have a chance to get away with that. I think that this final that it looks like being is going to be a fascinating final. I think Juventus believe that they can win it. I think that, I can't remember if I mentioned this already or not, Dani Alves has really sort of added something in that team. I think he's really giving them an upgrade at right back. At the same time, you've got Alexandre at left back, who is kicking on in a huge way. I was sort of surprised by the lineup again in midweek. We haven't seen a lot of Barzagli recently, and perhaps you were beginning to think that he was no longer even the guy they would turn to in those situations at centre back. They've got Daniele Rugani coming through, who's had a really solid season, but that knowledge and experience is obviously what Allegri wanted to go with in this game. And again, we talked about...
Yeah, so he put, was 33, 34, Barzagli?
Barzagli, 35.
Oh, is he 35? Yeah. And he was on 18-year-old Mbappe?
Yeah.
And a pretty good job of shutting him down.
Yeah, I mean, he did lose him once or twice. But I think again, what's sort of interesting about both these semi-finals, teams that won, this was an unexpected tactical shift from Allegri. He went to a 3-5-2, but it was flexible, as his formations always are. They're one thing in possession, another thing out of possession. But I think Allegri is one of those managers who makes a different plan for every game. He's not someone who comes with the same idea week after week after week, certainly the big games anyway. And I think that's what will be so fun about this final, assuming that is indeed the final, is that Allegri will come with a special plan for Real Madrid. And we'll see if Zidane will come with a special plan for Juventus as well.
Ooh, all right. We've got second legs to go, of course. Higuain getting both goals for Juve after a bizarre, really bizarre series of stumbles and kind of mishits. Dani Alves laying on both balls for Higuain. And although the pass of the night, I would suggest, is Dybala's incredible diagonal ball for Dani Alves in the second half. Buffon, Burn Van 3000, asking, is the 32 million Juve played for Buffon in 2001 the most cost-effective transfer of all time? I would say probably yes. Barry, what do you think?
Yeah, I'd imagine so. I mean, that was his 100th Champions League appearance.
Was it?
And he's kept 44 clean sheets, which is pretty good numbers.
Right.
I would be very, very sad if Juventus get to the final and don't win it.
Oh, and don't win it?
Yeah.
For Buffon?
For Buffon.
Right.
That is, I mean, historically, that is Juventus' shtick.
Yeah, I'm well aware of that.
Well, 98 against Real Madrid.
Yeah.
96, of course, they won it in Rome against Ajax. 2003, losing it in the final against Milan.
Lost to Borussia Dortmund, Zidane's first year in
1997.
Yeah.
I was surprised at it. They've only won it twice.
And one of those was Heisel.
Yeah, I didn't realise they'd won it so.
And the other time was on penalties, I think, wasn't it, against Ajax? Yes. Yeah, all right. And how about that Stade Louis II atmosphere for this special Champions League semi-final? Extraordinary, no, for a game this big.
Well, it's renowned as a vacuum, isn't it?
It was amazing, I thought, even for there. All right. Anything you want to throw at us about Juve, Michael? I mean, we know they're an incredibly well-disciplined and drilled machine, but...
No, I mean, I'd echo what Paolo said, but I thought the interesting thing with this was when Allegri took over, he obviously inherited a really fantastic team. And I think a lot of the credit he got in the first couple of seasons was not disturbing that too much. But when you look at that team, particularly in midfield, you know, Pirlo's gone, Vidal's gone, Pogba's gone. He's essentially built a new team with Khedira, with Pjanic, with Dybala. And it now, more than ever, I think just feels like Allegri's team. Mm. You know, it's not just he's kept things going. He's built something different and they're just really effective.
Right. Dybala signed a new deal. Is Allegri going to be there next year?
I think so at this point, yeah. It's looking more and more like it. He's getting everything that he wants there. I don't know what he'd run away from. And I know because I've had the conversation with him myself before. He is interested in coaching in England, but I just don't see that this is the time he's going to walk away from this project. He's still, in managerial terms, quite young, so he has time on his side to do that when he wants to. I guess the only other thing to say, because you touched on Higuain, we talked about Ronaldo being the big game player. Higuain has traditionally been the not big game player, and you're right, he sort of had this bizarre start to the game where he fell over and then didn't jump, you know, didn't attack a ball from Dani Alves, and then hooked the ball back in at the post from a corner when he should have shot, and everyone was thinking, you know, is this going to be the same old story? Because of course, he's, you know, again, he's acknowledged it himself in interviews. They did not spend 90 million euros on him to just score goals in the league. They signed him to get into this final. There was a fun quote from Corriere della Sera, which it sort of put me in mind of, because he said that when he was at Real Madrid and chatting with Ruud van Nistelrooy told him that goals are like ketchup.
Yeah.
He said you can shake the bottle, and it all comes out at once. So if Juventus are going to win this thing, I dare say they need that ketchup bottle to have a bit more left in it.
Yeah, nowadays they have squeezy technology, which kind of really it irons out that whole kink in the distribution.
Yeah, you still get some left in the bottom of the bottle, though, don't you?
Is that right? I haven't had ketchup in ages. Of course, as many people pointed out on Twitter after people posted that Ruud van Nistelrooy anecdote, it'll be Atleti and Monaco who'll be all about ketchup next week. And then there's various relish things you can say and stuff. I'll just move on now. Do you want to talk about the other Europa League game, which bizarrely was played on the Wednesday, or should we do that later on? Is there much to say? Did you see Ajax?
It was really entertaining.
It was a crazily open game.
It reminded me of, like, if you go to a kind of sporting event and they have, like, the kids on beforehand, because the Champions League was the main event.
Right.
And this was, like, there was no discipline, there was no defending, it was just all-out attack, but it was fantastic to watch.
37 shots.
Really?
Yeah, 37 shots. Ajax winning 4-1 against the just ludicrously open Lyon team. Two from Chelsea loanee Bertrand Traore. Kasper Dolberg, Ajax's teen sensation on the score sheet once again. Paolo.
I was just going to say, because I guess I don't watch Ajax all that often, hearing them sing Bob Marley, the fans coming in at half-time, as a contrast to the Monaco atmosphere, I thought that was wonderful.
Yeah.
Why was that game played on Wednesday?
Because of Dutch Remembrance Day, which is today. Happy Dutch Remembrance Day, if happy is an appropriate word, but, you know, Dutch Remembrance Day to you, Dutch listeners. Right. Oh, Michael Booth, caught in controversy here, says, would the pod be willing to discuss the failure of English teams in the UCL and what contributes towards it? I'm looking round our panel for enthusiasm for that particular task. I tell you what, we'll have a bit of music and come back. Right. Producer Ben says, that sounds like a Blizzard question. Michael, were you asked that on a Blizzard panel, what would you respond? Briefly.
Well, I think over the last few years, English football's kind of slipped behind the times tactically. English football, or English sides became very good in the Champions League when Mourinho and Benitez came in kind of 2004. They'd already had European success. They introduced new kind of tactics. There's no reason now why we should fail, because Premier League supposedly has the best managers in the world.
Yeah.
I think this year the failure's been kind of four very different teams for four different reasons, really. I'm not sure there's something that unites them all.
Okay,
I mean, Leicester did better than expected. Tottenham seemed kind of a little bit underprepared for the tactical task they faced.
Tottenham's something that a lot of people mentioned, because we gave Spurs, we kind of broke the habit of a lifetime and gave Spurs some love on Monday. And look where it got us. Loads of people writing in saying, well, if Spurs are so good, why did they crash out of a Champions League group stage that featured, amongst others, 12th place in the Bundesliga, Leverkusen, and out of the Europa League by Ghent?
Well, there seems to be there's the Wembley hoodoo for a start. And I think the Spurs team that was dumped out of the Champions League group stages was sort of a pale facsimile of the current Spurs team, even though it features the same personnel, but they just weren't playing as well.
That was the worst patch of the season, wasn't it, basically, that sort of stretch from October?
It was a poor showing by them. They shouldn't have been dumped out, and I was surprised by it. But I think the way they're playing now, they would have got through that group easily.
All right, so that's that and Wembley for Spurs. Arsenal. And City? And who was the other team? Oh, yeah. I mean, Leicester were kind of wild card anyway. City?
Well, City just defended terribly in that game against Monaco, and indeed in the first leg against Monaco.
Right.
Defensively, they're just not a very good team, City. I think overall, Manchester City have been quite interesting this season, because when Guardiola took over, he kind of reformatted them completely. And now they just seem more like Pellegrini's Manchester City or Mancini's Manchester City. There's no real Guardiola identity about them. They're just quite. I think they've massively underachieved this season.
Well, yeah, and I would find it concerning were I a Man City fan to look at the way that their form has hit, you know, the curve of their form has dipped. You start out brilliantly, and the more time you spend with a manager, the less effective he becomes, from 10 straight wins at the start of the season to, what, 2 wins in the last 8, I think, now.
Something like that, yeah.
But if you look at last year's Premier League table, you know, once it all finished, Spurs, City, United and Liverpool are all, well, I mean, Spurs have 7 points more than they finished with last season. City have the same amount with several games left to play. Manchester United are, well, they weren't in Champions League, but they're a point, 1 point fewer than they had at the end of last season. And Liverpool have 9 points more than they had at the end of last season, all with games still to come. So they've all improved.
Right.
Which renders, they've improved domestically, but not in Europe.
Right.
I can't think of any particularly rational explanation for it.
I mean, in terms of structural reasons, and, you know, there have been times, as Michael's already said, when English football has done better in Europe, that there is still a sense that in England there are too many games played, and that there are, you know, the lack of a winter break costs something. I think certainly
Monaco played more games than Man City did.
Sure, it's not a universal. It doesn't mean that it sort of works. It applies in every single instance. But certainly, for instance, Bundesliga teams are playing less games, and Italian teams are playing less games because they're not playing in an equivalent of the League Cup. You know, they haven't got that to worry about. I have had plenty of players. I know it's sort of a thing that tends to still, people like to bury their heads in the sand over here, but I've enough players have told me individually and have told other interviewers down the years that the winter break makes a difference for me to think that there probably is something in the fact that the winter break makes a difference to players. So there are some reasons structurally. I don't think that explains all of it, but I also think we shouldn't be ignoring it altogether.
Do teams in Italy, Spain and Germany, when they have their winter break, go on tours?
Some do.
Right, because that's what would happen in this country. Everyone would hot-foot it to China or Australia to play games.
I mean, certainly, for example, Milan will head over to Dubai usually and do warm weather training.
Yeah.
But a tour per se?
You're right. I don't know whether you'd define that as a tour or not. They're not necessarily playing games.
Interesting.
But I would imagine a tour would be more grueling than actually playing league games.
Yeah, and very possible with the air
absolutely travel. Without doubt what all the top teams would do in the Premier League if there was a winter break.
I think it's also worth saying that there's been a bit of a shift in the Premier League over the last few years in terms of the speed of games. I mean, when English sides were good in the Champions League, football was quite defensive. Mourinho, Benitez, that era was really defensive. Then there was a possession era and, you know, it was quite a slow style of football that people got back. You watch Premier League games now and they're just terrifyingly quick. And it's easy to, you know, envisage that the players are just exhausted because they're being asked to play this really heavy pressing style in not very nice weather on slightly boggy pitches compared to European countries. I do think a lot of English teams are just exhausted.
Right.
And partly that is the winter break and partly the style of football they're playing.
Yeah, it's interesting, Michael. You're suggesting that there's been kind of different tactical eras, even within the Premier League era, that, you know, it would be fascinating in many ways to take to cut through the rock face of the Premier League and have a look at the different strata.
Yeah, that would be good if you're interested in reading the book. It's called The Mixer. It's out next month.
I was going to segue into it, but you've just gone and thrown it out there brazenly.
I knew what you were implying.
You've done a book called The Mixer.
Yeah, it's about the history of Premier League tactics.
Right, okay. And The Mixer, you know, where you put it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's an ironic reference to it.
All right, you hold on a second. I'll just talk about your book for a second. Are there pictures in it, for example?
No.
Any chalkboards?
No. Sorry, no.
No diagrams?
No, it's controversial, but it's just words.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I presumed there would be the usual green rectangles with red circles.
No, sadly not. You have to imagine them.
Like a magnetic board that you could move little dots around. You could have that. The back cover was on the hardback edition was magnetic, you could just move the dots.
It's quite a good idea.
Yeah, it's genuinely
a good idea.
Yeah. Or on the ebook edition, obviously you could do something electronic. Here's Peter Nichols, I found the question now. He says, can we ask zonal marking, by night known as Michael Cox, about his new book, please? specifically, what's his favourite tactical team of the EPL era? What's your favourite tactical team of the EPL era, Michael?
Can I cheat slightly and say that it's Newcastle because they had no tactics whatsoever?
Ooh.
It's just really interesting. They just didn't mention the opposition. They didn't do any work on set pieces.
Is Keegan era.
Keegan era, yeah.
Yeah.
Their training was incredible. They just turned up, played head tennis for like half an hour. And I gather the best doubles partnership was Keegan and Terry McDermott, which I really like.
Okay.
And then they just played five aside and did some shooting drills at the end and went home.
Right. Because that team did nearly win something.
Yeah.
You know.
And the weird thing is, everyone talks about how bad their defensive record is, but it was actually quite good. They conceded less than a goal a game, but they scored fewer goals than any other Premier League champion.
Really?
Which is amazing because they were the entertainers, but they weren't actually that entertaining.
It just goes to show that maybe it's not goals that are overrated, maybe it's tactics that are overrated.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a good point.
You're basically writing yourself out of a job.
Yeah. That is true.
Is there a chapter about Newcastle and their absence of tactics in the book?
A fun chapter.
Is it a fun chapter?
Yeah, I think it's the funnest chapter.
Is it a dry book, Michael, or are there laughs there? Would I get it?
I think there's more anecdotes than maybe you'd expect.
All right.
Yeah. It's quite fun.
I think Jimbo wants to know is it more or less boring than inverting the pyramid?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I'll give you a copy and then you can read both.
All right, maybe we can have an extract or something.
Please.
Yeah? We'll do an extract. Now, far away from the bright lights, the Champions League, Premier League teams facing each other. Spurs are playing Friday night at the London Stadium against West Ham, so they could actually close to 1 point off Chelsea, who are not going to be in action until Monday, when they will be at home to a Middlesbrough team that has only had one away win all season. So probably everything's going to stay more or less the same there. At the bottom, Middlesbrough can officially be relegated this weekend if Hull get a point and Swansea win. Hull, who are 2 points clear of Swansea, will be hosting Sunderland, so ka-ching there in points terms. Swansea will be hosting Everton. Meanwhile, there's a kind of fifth, sixth tussle, which is firing up everyone's imagination at the Emirates, as Man United, who are 1 point behind City in the race for top four spots, visit an Arsenal side who are six behind City but do have a game in hand. How long is Man United's unbeaten run now? 25.
Yeah.
I say now, but they may have played Celta Vigo by the time you hear this, listeners. One can only guess at what's going to happen there, given their many, many problems at the back. And also, Mourinho's come out and said, and I don't know if we can trust him on this, but he's going to rest his players for the Arsenal game, or in the Arsenal game, for the second leg against Celta Vigo.
Mind games.
Is that what it is?
Mind
it worked
games.
On me.
I don't know. I'm just saying that because everything Mourinho says is mind games. We all know this. But it's certainly a provocative line. The idea that the Europa League is now more interesting to him than finishing the top four, I think. Obviously, they both get you into the Champions League. I don't think for a second that Jose will be doing anything other than trying to beat Arsene Wenger, who he seems to enjoy beating almost more than anybody else on Sunday.
Though it's worth pointing out that 3 years ago he rested half his team for a trip to Liverpool ahead of a Champions League semi-final, and they still won 2-0 and essentially denied Liverpool the title.
Oh, right, that game.
Mm.
That was the Gerrard slip match.
It was, yeah.
Huh.
There's some weird players in that. Players you would have forgotten about.
Go on, then.
Slash never heard of. Thomas Kalas.
Oh, yeah.
Played centre-back. Do you remember him?
For Chelsea. No idea who that would be.
But they kept a clean sheet against
If you're listening,
Suarez,
Thomas, by the way, I'm really sorry. Maybe he's gone on to great things.
Not sure.
Okay. All right. Barry, what do you think? Can Arsenal end United's unbeaten run, assuming Celta haven't already done that?
They possibly can. I'd sort of beyond caring what Arsenal do at this stage. If they play as badly as they did against Tottenham, one would imagine they won't. Trouble Manchester United, even a second string Manchester United team unduly. That performance was totally embarrassing.
If they win this, they'll be 2 points behind United with a game in hand. Yeah. Problem is, in nine matches against the top six, they've only picked up 6 points. Here's a post from Yellow Balls who says, "My question is, why do you mock Arsene Wenger so? You mimic his voice like a playground bully and deride him each week." Anyway, he makes a very well-reasoned point about the fact that Arsenal's actually won loads and all these people that we're getting excited about, like Spurs, haven't actually won anything. So lay off, and he could win an FA Cup and that. Ariakani agrees. He said, last two pods, Arsenal have got a hard time. Having won two of the last three FA Cups, they're in a fourth final. They finished second in the Premier League last year. Remind me what Spurs have won in 10 years. Has Pochettino won a single trophy at Spurs? Asking for a friend, says Aria. Here's Josh Brown with a stat for you guys. Say what you like about Sunderland, they have a better away record against the top 10 than Arsenal this season. Sunderland have a better away record against the top 10 teams, and that includes sides like West Brom, than Arsenal do. Do you want to call that game for us, Michael? Do you think Arsenal are going to get the win they so badly need?
No, I think it'll be a draw.
Now, elsewhere in the top four, you asked about Spurs. Are they going to keep the pressure up on Chelsea with a win at West Ham?
You would imagine so. Apparently, Slaven Bilic has been given two games to save his job.
Oh, really?
This being the first of them, and the second one being against Liverpool, which seems a mighty unfair on him. But then again, his employers are not the most fair people in the world.
But that would mean that they'd bring in a new manager for the last game of the season?
I don't know. If the press have been briefed that this is the state of affairs, he's clearly not really wanted there, and it would be silly to resign and miss out on a nice big payoff, but you'd like to think he'd walk away with his head held high. But no, I of course would also stick in there for the money.
Oh, sit tight. They've won 9 games in a row, have Spurs, although none of those were against Bayer Leverkusen. And Ghent. And they've not conceded in 4 matches. And Harry Kane loves a London derby.
Yeah, but I mean, West Ham sort of love this particular derby for ruining Tottenham's plans as a general rule. Obviously, there was the famous one is the Lasagna game, but they also last season, I believe, they threw a spanner in Tottenham's works late in the season. They have a habit of undermining Tottenham, and they really enjoy undermining Tottenham. So, and that on that basis, they've certainly been a motivated team. I think that the issue for West Ham, I think Andy Carroll is now a maybe for, well, not even a maybe. I think Bilic says he's going to play, but not 90 minutes this weekend. I mean, the last couple of games, they have looked desperately sort of blunt up front with Ayew, who's not really a centre forward, and Kayeri, who doesn't seem to score goals like a centre forward. So the question of where the goals is coming from is the big one. And also West Ham have been, I think they've got something like the fourth, I think there's only 3 teams in the league have won less games at home than they have this season. So the London Stadium has not exactly been a happy place for them most of the time. But yes, West Ham, certainly their fans, I don't know if the players really care about it as much, but the fans certainly enjoy getting one over on Tottenham, so they won't be short of motivation in that sense.
All right.
Be interesting to see how the London Stadium handles a Friday night game between West Ham and Spurs as well. I'm slightly surprised it's been moved to Friday night.
Because it's a little bit at risk as fixtures go.
Yeah, I think so, more than most. I mean, it's the first time I think that there's been a London derby there since that Chelsea game when they had quite a lot of trouble earlier in the season. Hopefully security has been improved since then.
And there is no love lost between West Ham and Spurs fans.
Indeed not.
I mean, Spurs wanted to be playing there, didn't they?
That's so true.
The London Stadium. It's the London Stadium derby.
This is what you could have won.
Yeah. Although the fans probably didn't want to be playing there.
I suspect they're very grateful that it didn't go their way. In other top four news, you've got Liverpool, who are hosting Saints. Of course, Liverpool have been in action since we last spoke. They had that very exciting match at Watford on Monday. One of the worst games of the season, enlivened briefly by one of the goals of the season, Emre Can's remarkable overhead kick. Would you have this as your goal of the season in the Premier League?
I'm struggling on the spot to think of one that was better.
Well, you've got the two kind of scorpion kicks from Giroud and Mkhitaryan.
Yeah, and there was Andy Carroll's kick.
Yeah, that was... it was more of a sideways kick, that one, but it was just lashed in. It was beautiful.
I think I prefer Andy Carroll's. To be honest, I was at the Crucible for this, and I was in the press room when that goal went in, and it got a bigger cheer than any of the actual snooker that was being played.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. It was a great goal.
And it wasn't because they were Liverpool fans. It was just, what a goal, cheer.
Yeah. 3 big points for Liverpool, although they did have one or two nervous moments later on. Prudel on a set piece, almost equalising for the Hornets. But now Liverpool take on Saints, and they've played them 3 times this season, and Liverpool have yet to score a goal against them. Interesting. Interesting. Manchester City, who lie fourth, are at home to Crystal Palace in the early game on Saturday. City, I mentioned, have only won two of their last eight and only scraped a point against Borough through nefarious means. There's some doubt, is there, about Aguero?
I believe there is, yes.
Yeah, okay. That would be big.
That's a good excuse to play Jesus, though.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Four goals in four. And David Silva, is he going to be there to work his magic?
I'm not sure. Let's hope so. It'll be a victory for all of us, I think, if David Silva's playing.
Absolutely. Palace have got a good record away from home. Better, much better than they do at home. Ian McIntosh insists they're still not safe. They've got Hull to come at home after this and then Man United. I'm not sure. They do have Dan and Kabai hopefully returning after missing their defeat against Burnley. But no Sacco, of course. I'm not. City Palace?
Well, I mean, Palace have won, what, Anfield and Stamford Bridge in the last month?
That's true.
Why not? You know, I don't think it's an easy game for City at all.
There you go. How about we take a second or two and then talk about the teams down at the bottom?
Over the last 18 months, more than 125,000 men have stopped wasting time and money on their shaving supplies and signed up with Cornerstone, who just happened to be the official shaving partner of Football Weekly. Cornerstone have just launched their brand new razor with super-heated and ice-hardened Japanese chromium steel blades. Woof! Try it for yourself and take £10 off your first order at cornerstone.co.uk/guardian.
No one seems very excited about the top four. Perhaps you'll be more exorcised by the struggle for Premier League survival, Barry, which no longer applies to you.
Well, you know, they say it's mathematically impossible for Sunderland to stay up now, but...
Who are they?
Who trusts these so-called mathematical experts?
Absolutely.
Sunderland are gone. I don't think anyone's going to miss them. And I'd say it could be a long time before they're back.
Really? Do you think?
Yeah.
Sunderland have failed to score in their last, in 11 of their last 13 games. And that looks like Hull should get some vital points in their battle against the drop. Remember, they are just the right side of that dotted line. 2 points ahead of Swansea, who take on an Everton team that they drew 1-1 with at Goodison earlier in the season.
I actually have a feeling Sunderland are going to beat Hull.
Because
it doesn't matter anymore.
Right.
And it's a stress-free game. And yeah. They can
I have a feeling
them.
They won't, Barry, but we'll see who's right.
Okay.
Yeah. What do you think about Swansea and Everton?
It's an interesting one. Swansea played quite well against Manchester United. It's good as they have in a while, although the bar is quite low. Everton, they haven't been good recently, and it's a tough one to call. I wouldn't be a bit surprised if Swansea beat.
Yeah. As I say, 1-1
some searing analysis here.
No, that's spot on, Michael.
Yeah, I agree. I think Everton's defeat to Chelsea means that they can't, you know, they had outside the hopes of the top four, that's pretty much gone. I can imagine them switching off. And I think Swansea will win. I think Swansea were fantastic against Manchester United. Mm. I haven't seen them that much this season, but it's bizarre to me that you can play that well away at Old Trafford and be in the position they're in.
Is it fair to say that the return of Llorente, I mean, obviously having a big goal-scoring centre-forward back is a big thing, but it let them get some end product to their always decent tactical play.
Yeah, that is true. Although he did miss a good chance at the end
did
of
he?
That game. Sigurdsson's just playing really well. I'm not convinced by Sigurdsson overall as a player, I must
really?
Say. I think
what doesn't convince you?
I think he fades out of games quite easily and provides sporadic moments of magic.
Barry's favourite player.
But for a side like Swansea, who just needs some attacking invention, he's great.
Is that right, Barry? You still your favourite player, Gylfi Sigurdsson?
I wouldn't say he's my favourite player, but I have a lot of time for
right.
him.
Right, he's a Gylfi pleasure. I'm sure we've said that before. Yeah. Just on the Everton thing, of course, everyone here would send their best wishes to Aaron Lennon. I hope he feels better soon.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, for that last spot in the trip down to the Championship, after this, Swansea have Sunderland away and then West Brom at home, while Hull have Palace at Selhurst Park and then Spurs at home. So
Sunderland could, as well as going down, could have a major say in who they'd drag down with them.
Swansea, they've got a decent run in, haven't
that's
they?
That's a great fixture list, because West Brom are currently on a run of 465 minutes without scoring a goal.
Yeah, and despite that, they're still eighth.
Yeah, yeah.
What does that tell you about what's going on? Below the kind of top seven, I guess, if we include Everton. Well, there's just some real rubbish.
Well, there's a massive gap, isn't it? Between seventh and eighth, there's a 14-point gap.
Wow.
But maybe more enlightening, the top seven have all got a goal difference of plus 20 or more, and everyone else has got minus four or less.
Wow.
So it's just there's two different divisions in the Premier League.
Mm-hmm. Well, anyway, West Brom, who are they going to be playing? Oh, they're at Burnley. Rob Skelton says, Burnley, I've listened to Football Weekly all year. There's not been much mention of Burnley, despite their wonderful achievement, you know, staying up. He says, for your information, I'm a Liverpool fan. So well done to Burnley.
Is staying up in that league a wonderful achievement?
In the Premier League?
There are a lot
with
of
their resources.
Very, very bad teams in that league. It shouldn't take much to stay in, I think.
Well, they're in 14th place.
No, they have done very well. Mm. And, Sean Dyche seems like a decent guy, although he does come out with some sort of dinosaur stuff occasionally. Not actual paleontology, but you know, some of his views are a bit prehistoric. I think, you know, if Hull were to stay up, that would be a wonderful achievement,
right,
because of the absolute pig's ear of a squad they had going when the season started. Mm. They could barely field a team. That would be a wonderful achievement. But, you know, there are some, from West Brom down, there are some awful teams in that league, and staying, just not being one of the three worst shouldn't be that difficult.
All right, it's an interesting perspective.
Am I being unfair?
I don't know. It's an interesting perspective. Burnley, though, with a win here, could find themselves as high as ninth. As high as ninth, top half of the Premier League. Woo! Now, also in that lump of, that glut of teams that don't appear to be that great, you've got Leicester, who will be facing Watford. Both teams are on 40 points. Bournemouth are taking on Stoke. Josh King is set to become the highest scoring Norwegian in the Premier League ever. He's currently level on Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. Highest scoring in one season. He's got 15, which I think puts him level on Solskjaer. Right. Which is certainly a fact about Bournemouth's clash with Stoke. We will be moving on to all sorts of other things after this. There's loads of stuff still to talk about, listeners. Absolutely no question that you'd want to go anywhere else. But if you are bored of this podcast, I can tell you that there are some other options available for you in the limited world of podcasting. Ben, as in producer Ben, and John Ashton have just made a new episode of their Parts Unknown wrestling podcast, in which they'll be giving their thoughts on the House of Horrors match at WWE's Payback. In brackets, ooh, scary, it says here. Also, and considerably less excitingly, there's another installment of that exciting new movie podcast that's really everyone's talking about. It's called Truth and Movies, as you know, listeners. And there's some controversy there in there about whether venerated Japanese noodle opus Tampopo is actually a bit like Karate Kid rewritten by the artistic team from Hello Kitty. And also we discuss the exciting new British comedy Mindhorn, which turns out is way better than the dreadful trailers would make you believe. And there's other stuff too.
Would you say that the film Tampopo is one you should watch in a workplace where other people could walk in?
I would say no, because that happened to me, and there's a scene midway through where, and this is going to sell the movie. Basically, I'm sat at work, I've got a couple of downtime, and I'm watching in the kind of dressing room on my laptop, and another presenter walks in at the precise moment that a Yakuza squeezes salt and lemon on his courtesan's nipples and licks them off, and then places live prawns on her body, and then they swap an egg yolk, you know. Mouth to mouth. That's an exciting bit of Tampopo.
Sorry, Tampopo.
Anyway, in live event news, Football Weekly Live is at the Emmanuel Centre in Westminster, but it's sold out. So your next best option is to visit the Fair City of Dublin only two nights later on Wednesday the 7th of June, when we'll be at the National Stadium. And given how big that place is, there's bound to be tickets available, at least in the upper tier. That's me, Barry Barney, and Amy Lawrence. Robert Murphy says regarding that, fun factoid for your upcoming trip, National Stadium in Dublin is the world's oldest purpose-built boxing arena. How about that? And probably the largest, although he didn't mention that. Finally...
I'm amazed they didn't have Joshua Klitschko there.
Really?
Yeah.
Probably too big.
Yeah, they went for the more intimate surroundings of Wembley.
One for the fans, yeah. Paolo, you, me and James Horncastle, we're going to do a Gazzetta Football Italian night at London's Union Chapel, in which we'll kind of wax nostalgic about the grand old days of Calcio and then make vaguely optimistic noises about how it's all just around the corner again and play some old clips of players and generally kind of remember the good old days when we...
It'll be wildly entertaining, just like Dublin was.
Exactly. That's going to be on Monday, 19th of June, and tickets very much available at theguardian.com/footballweekly. Producer Ben, by the way, wants to know what an optimistic noise would sound like. I think probably something like a, ooh. Yeah? That's certainly the one I would use. A pessimistic noise would be more like, And that's Paolo's happy noise, by the way. Jazz Horse, by the way, says, nice nod to the Ajax team of 2003, which had all those crazy... I mean, what a lineup! They're Mido, Zlatan, Van der Meijden, Van der Vaart.
Schneider.
Schneider was in it. Christian Kivu, adds Jazz Horse. He was in that, as well as Nigel de Jong, Hatem Trabelsi, and Martin Stecklenburg. Also worthy of note, says Jazz Horse, Andy Van der Meijden's career may have stalled due to various issues with injury and illness. But his career did end on a happy note. He refereed the final of the Lingerie World Cup in 2014, which the Netherlands won on home soil. Take this hammer, responds. I hear the opposition were pretty pants.
Andy van der Meijden also did one of the most remarkable tweets I've ever seen.
What was that?
About a year ago. And I hope I get the details of this right, but the tweet was just, I just got a phone call asking me to be a UNICEF ambassador. I told them to f*** off.
Oh my God.
I'm going to have to check that, check I haven't got it wrong.
Andy van der Meijden.
I'm sure it was him.
Former Inter star, my word. That's extraordinary. I mentioned Where Are They Nows. Nigel Coca. Mike, is this something that's been exciting you? He's been in the MLS, since 2013. He was on trial as part of the Tony Adams experiment.
Yeah.
But he's now joined Norwegian club IK Start. He's 32?
Yeah. That surprises me because I always thought IK Start was Swedish. I mean, I'm the one who's wrong, I'm sure.
I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm just reading things off a piece of paper. Here's something else that's written on this sheet. Lee Boyer runs a carp fishing lake in France.
I knew that.
Did you? Mm. Does he live there as well?
I don't know. I presume he spends some time there or else he wouldn't be running it.
All right. Do you know what Thomas Greveson's doing these days?
No.
He's a professional poker player worth 100 million euros. Damn. Arwin de Zeeuw, who was he and what's he doing now?
Well, he played for Wigan, amongst others.
But did he?
I think he was...
What era was that?
Mid-2000s.
Okay.
Wasn't he spat up by someone?
Okay.
I think he's a doctor.
You're wrong. He's a PI. He's a private dick. He's a gumshoe.
Oh, okay.
Ken Moncow. Everybody knows what he's doing these days, don't they?
No.
They do if they fancy a pancake and they live near his childhood home in Rotterdam, because that's where he's got a pancake restaurant. I bumped into him one day, coming back from a fireworks night. And he mentioned the pancake shop. Crepes. To conclude our Where Are They Now section, Thomas Callas, who you mentioned back at, back in the dawn of time in part one. Yeah. Do you know where he is now, Michael?
No.
He's still on Chelsea's books. But they've loaned him out to Fulham. Where he's now set for a promotion playoff. Wow. With the Cottagers. Okay, to conclude... Italy. But there's something for everyone here, not just Italian football fans. I think all right-thinking people will have been surprised to read of the situation involving Sully Alimuntari, and not just him, to be fair, but his is the incident which has really shone a spotlight, if you will, on this ongoing problem in Serie A of racist abuse from fans, after he was handed a one-game suspension by the Italian Federation for walking off the pitch when the referee gave him a yellow card after he complained of being abused by fans at the Santalia during Pescara's game away at Cagliari.
Yeah, I mean, the suspension, just sort of to be technical about it, the suspension is effectively because he ultimately was sent off in the referee's official report. Like, okay. So he got a yellow card, he walked off, the referee was like, all right, then you get a second yellow card for, I guess, extended dissent. It becomes a red card, it becomes a one-game suspension. In terms of applying the letter of the law, fine. I mean, obviously, it seems wildly wrong-headed that a player gets abused, and when he tries to intervene and get the referee's support on this, what he gets instead is a yellow card. Perhaps Montari was overly forceful in the way he addressed the referee, but I think you're going to have a lot of sympathy for a guy who's having to put up with that at his job. I mean, and I know that some of the reaction in Italy has been... unfortunately, not all of it, by the way. There has been a lot of condemnation of this as well, but there has been some element of reaction, which is, oh, it was only 10 people. And
well, that's what the official reaction is. In any case, deplorable racial discriminatory chants were only heard due to the fact that the fans at the time were participating in a silent protest.
Yeah.
As if that mitigates
it. Yeah, well, I mean, the first thing to say is that, look, Cagliari, this is a situation, if it really was 10 people, then I cannot for the life of me understand why this wasn't dealt with by stewards. If you have stewards in a stadium and someone is being clearly racially abused by 10 people, why have they not been let out of the stadium? But there is this sort of ridiculous rule currently in force where if it's fewer than 1%, the team doesn't get fines. The team will receive no punishment for this going on. And it all ends up not for the first time casting a sort of terrible light on Italian football. And I think, unfortunately, when everyone's looking for leadership on this and for someone to sort of step up and do something about it, when the person in charge of your football federation was able to win their position as head of the football federation despite making some particularly unpleasant remarks about banana eaters in the lower division, what do you expect?
Remarks which he served a 6-month ban from FIFA for.
Yes, but yes, remarkably, this didn't stop him from holding the position that he continues to hold at the Italian Football Federation.
Yeah. The Players' Union, FIFPro, called on Italian authorities to rescind the ban and, for their players not to take the field. Do you think there's going to be a turnaround on this, especially given the amount of outcry there's been, both nationally and internationally?
It would certainly be easy enough for Pescara to make a protest because they've been relegated anyway, so it's not like they stand to lose anything. But as of the time of recording this podcast, I have not heard that anyone is planning to boycott games on Sunday.
Okay.
I was kind of surprised by the lack of solidarity of Montari's teammates when this happened. You'd like to think in a perfect world they'd have walked off with him.
Yeah. It's funny because I had a pet theory, and I don't know how relevant this is, but when you look at the level of immigration and what period of time it occurs, certainly that the level of people coming into, say, Great Britain happened in vast numbers decades earlier than it has been doing in, say, Italy. And as such, it's kind of interesting to draw parallels between where societies are and the way they react, say, in Italy now and maybe in Great Britain a couple of decades ago, not suggesting in any way that the problem's been eradicated in Great Britain. But the longer people are in a community, the more people, other people, realise that everyone is just people. And when you say that, Barry, it directly echoes with what Leroy Rossini was saying when we chatted about his book, It's Only Banter, which we did a little podcast interview, which is available, where he said that it was something that really he couldn't get to grips with as a young player. The fact that if, say, an opposition player did something to hurt him, his teammates would be there in solidarity, but he could get any level of abuse or being spat at by fans, and they would just feel like, no, you just got to suck it up. It's all part of the game. In some cases, it's only banter. That it's all part of the job. You just got to play on. And I suspect that's possibly, although that's my supposition, that's possibly still the
That doesn't sound ludicrous.
No. I mean, Italy, where previous gestures aimed at solidarity have included Treviso's players taking to the field blacked up.
Yeah. To support... I know it's easy to laugh at that, but actually, like the player in question, Omlade, was actually very grateful for that show. Right. He played in the game, he came on as a sub and scored in that game, and it was generally, that was not something done sort of in mockery of him, that was done speaking to him, and I appreciate culturally that looks awful.
Right. Fair enough.
And also, in fairness, after that, subsequent to that, there were, because everyone always talks about that game, there were quite high-profile sort of anti-racism campaigns in Italy in which I believe Shevchenko, Del Piero, a few players sort of did it on, you know, in TV adverts. So, like, it was... I understand how bad that looks and how shocking it looks. I think contextually, we can say that that was a genuine gesture. It wasn't a gesture intended to offend.
Yeah, perhaps a little naive, although, you know. Anyway, I did mention the fact that it's not an isolated example, because this last weekend you had both Inter and also Lazio fans placed, their clubs effectively given suspended stadium bans for abuse of Roma's Antonio Rudiger and Koulibaly of Napoli in the game at the San Siro.
Yeah, and this is the thing which comes back to about Cagliari not getting punished. It's because they have it's literally written into the rules that if it has to be more than 1%, which of course is a wildly hard thing to actually quantify. Mm. It has to be more than 1% of fans participating, and at Cagliari obviously was fewer than.
Right. Okay. Well, as I mentioned, this weekend in Italy you've got the Turin derby. You've also got some important games in the battle for top spots. Juve pretty much sorted. But it's very tight now between Roma in second and Napoli, who are only a point behind. Napoli are going to be hosting Cagliari. Roma are going to be at Milan, which will be Francesco Totti's last visit to the San Siro as a player, if he plays.
Yeah.
Because after all the hoo-ha last week when he announced, basically did this kind of big thing in the centre of town with his new boots and that, Monchi, who's just announced, confirmed he's taking over as sporting director there from Sevilla, one of the first things he's said is, oh yeah, by the way, and Francesco Totti's retiring, which is a slightly strange way for the news to be confirmed.
Yeah, and it sort of felt when it first came out like he'd been wrong-footed, didn't it? It felt like Totti had been stitched up so that he couldn't do what he does sometimes, which is go, actually, I'm going to carry on. But it sounds like Monchi had spoken to him and sort of had this conversation. I am surprised that it wasn't Totti himself who got to make that announcement, but it does feel like it's time. I think his intervention in games is less and less. I think it sort of feels like a real shame on certain levels. Certainly, I'm sure he won't be happy that his last ever derby is now going to be a defeat because they lost to Lazio last weekend. Mm. He's not going to achieve a goal which he quite clearly was chasing for a long time, which was to be Serie A's all-time leading goal scorer. He's still about 20 shy of Piola, so that's not going to happen either. But It's still time. He's going to be involved in the club. There's a 5 or 6 year contract waiting for him to be a director. So he's not disappearing from our footballing lives, I guess. But he is disappearing from the football pitch. Right. Soon.
He may not be the all time top goal scorer in Serie A, but he's the all time top one touch pass splitting the defence, sir. I mean, nobody's done that better, I don't think, over the years. Number of times he's just flicked it on.
Yeah, I know some people outside of Italy still don't appreciate quite what a beautiful player Totti has been to watch. He's been absolutely one of the most enjoyable footballers just to watch playing football in my lifetime.
Mm. Never finished higher than fifth in the Ballon d'Or voting or higher than 10th in the World Player of the Year award. Never played in a European semi-final. Yeah.
Won a World Cup, though.
Yeah, that's true. He did that.
He won the Scudetto with Roma, which is not something that...
With your boyhood club.
Yeah, not something...
Does it get better? Poor First Touch says, does Totti have the requisite qualifications to become a director? What's the role? Seems common in Europe, yet rarely practiced in England. I mean, I think, you know, he is Totti, which is probably all the qualification he needs. Yeah, what's he going to be doing, do you think, Paolo?
I strongly suspect his role is going to be mostly showing up at certain events and being Francesco Totti. I think that's my expectation, but I could be wrong.
All right. Well, he's got plenty of experience in that. Let's finish off then, unless anybody's got anything else they wanted to discuss. With Pisa, who are bottom of Serie B, listeners, but have the best defensive record in the division. How is this possible? Loads of people asking this. But Sasha Gurinov saying, listen, all these people jumping on the Pisa to go down with the best defensive record bandwagon. Feck off, I was there first, says a unusually aggressive Sasha there. So what's the story, Paolo? Are they still being managed by Rino Gattuso?
Yes, I believe so. Right. I mean, I was just going to bring up the numbers. The story, in short, is that you can be relegated and sit bottom of the division without conceding many goals if you don't score any goals.
All right, what are the numbers then?
So they have conceded 29 goals, but they have scored just 22 in 39 games.
Caveat, Michael?
Well, they were given a 4 points deduction, but would that have made a difference?
No, they'd still be in the relegation zone. They'd still be in the bottom of three, even with those 4 points back.
Right. What does this tell us?
They wouldn't be last. They'd be up to second last.
Okay.
What does it tell us?
Yeah, what does it tell us?
That contrary to popularly stated wisdom on this show, sometimes goals really are what matter.
Right. Okay.
But Serie B is a ridiculous league, isn't it? It just every game's a draw, and there's no goals at all. It's like what people who don't like Syria think Syria is.
Right. Not us. Good. Well, that, I was going to say, is that. But Barry, we've left something out, haven't we?
We've forgotten about the championship, which reaches its denouement this weekend.
It's the final weekend.
Yes, so one of Blackburn, Nottingham Forest or Birmingham City are going to get relegated to League One. Brentford entertain Blackburn, Forest entertain Ipswich, and Birmingham are at Bristol City. So as things stand, Blackburn would go down. They're level on points with Forest, and they're minus 14. Forest are minus 13 in the goal difference stakes. If both of those sides were to win and Birmingham lost, or in fact drew, Birmingham would go down. So it's all very exciting.
That is exciting.
And Huddersfield Town, of course, got themselves in trouble for fielding a below-strength team at Birmingham last weekend.
Oh.
David Wagner made 10 changes from the team that had played the previous game. They lost 2-0. And the FA, or the Football League, have asked him to explain himself, and they may well get a fine.
Really?
Which I would imagine they'll be only too happy to pay. They're safe in the playoff places, so he's resting players for those. But the thing is, of the team he put out, I did a tot up. They had 260 appearances between them, which is an average of, what, 24 games a season each. So it's not like they're youth team players or callow reserves. And Wagner does rotate a lot. You know, Huddersfield are the fourth most rotated team in the championship, and it would not be uncommon for him to make up to 6 changes from one game to another. Well,
tell you what, if they need a brief for their hearing at the Football League, Barry, you do a fine job. Excellent. Well, we'll be reacting to all of that when we return on Monday for what looks set to be another exciting edition of Football Weekly. Do hope you have a great weekend in the meantime, everybody. But for now, it's many thanks to Barry, to Paolo, to Michael and producer Ben. And we'll see you on Monday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.